how assassinations are used in politics and in war. And we are just 110 years away from a major assassination that started the worst war of the 20th century, the greatest catastrophe in the history of mankind and civilization. So this iconic picture has gone around the world. President Donald Trump, with blood streaming over his face, being taken away by his Secret Service agents while he defiantly raises his fist in the air and shouts, fight, fight, fight. Bold, brave, and I must say, to have reacted so well, so quickly, quite extraordinary. And these Secret Service agents, you kind of wonder what job they were doing and what the instructions were that they missed. Here you've got, the shooter was only about 450 feet, about 150 meters away from where Trump was on the stage. Now, they did have some snipers positioned here for the Secret Service, and interestingly, it looks like they were looking straight at the shooter, and their guns were on target on him before he even fired the shot. And it took a few seconds after he shot 8 rounds at Trump before they responded. Makes you wonder, what is going on? Can they not see this is the most likely spot? If a shooter was wanting to shoot, that is the place where he would be. And where else would they be looking? I mean, where else is there an elevated position and just outside the secured area? Very suspicious. Interestingly, when the chief of the Secret Service, Kim Chico, was asked why they didn't secure that roof, she said it has a sloped roof and would be dangerous for them to place their men on it. Now, here, somebody, Jesse Walker, posted this saying, the White House says Secret Service agents on a sloped roof. And, you know, can you imagine Mission Impossible? Does it involve a sloped roof? You know, we can't operate in sloped roofs. Well, I think we've got people who operate in sloped roofs all the time. You couldn't repair them otherwise, could you? And that's a bit strange. Others have noticed the difference between the normal Secret Service agents who are built big and strong before DEI, Diversity, Equity and Inclusion, and how they look like now. And there's a whole lot of funny memes coming up now, like FBI DEI hire includes badge, weapons, sunglasses, holster puzzle. This poor creature was struggling over and over and over to try and get the weapon back into the holster and just didn't seem to be able to do it. I would have thought you'd done it so many times that, you know, it would come naturally. And you don't even have to look. A rubber stamp to bypass pesky merit-based advancement. So, another one, DEI another day. And, well, just look at, before DEI, there was Ronald Reagan, 1981, when he was shot, just 2.5 months into his presidency. And notice the Secret Service agents placing their bodies in front of the president, literally spreading himself out to take the shot, literally. And there were two agents got shot. The assailant fired 6 shots, and the 6th shot got Ronald Reagan. But he dropped 3 people before he could get to Ronald Reagan because the Secret Service agents were big and they were ready to put themselves before the principal, the president, and the shooter. And immediately you can see a very different kind of scene. These are Secret Service agents in 1981, quite different from the ones we're seeing today. Now, America's got a tradition of murdering their presidents, and 4 have been murdered in office, including Hinckley on this occasion, President McKinley, I should say. He was shot by an anarchist at Buffalo Fair, and that's 1901, and it was because of him being assassinated that then Teddy Roosevelt became president. He was the vice president at the time. And so Teddy Roosevelt was the first to get Secret Service agent protection because McKinley's assassination was just one thing too many. Now, you would have thought, considering he was shot in 1912 as he was running for presidency, for a third term, actually, and he was shot standing in an open vehicle, you would have thought the American Secret Service might have learned something from that. But before we get to that, President Roosevelt was also such a tough person. He took a bullet in the chest, and the bullet stayed with him the rest of his life. They couldn't get it out. And it didn't stop him from standing up and giving a 90-minute speech. And by the way, his leather glasses case also had a bit of metal in it, and it was sufficient to have stopped the bullet, sufficiently or slowed it down, but it didn't reach his heart and kill him, or his lungs. And so because he wasn't coughing up blood, he assumed that he could go ahead and he gave the speech. And although he said several times, it won't be much longer, he spoke for 90 minutes, absolutely whopping speech. And even though blood was covering his shirt, blood was covering his speech, he had a 50-page speech. And some people said the thickness of the speech stopped the bullet. In fact, the bullet did go through the speech, but it's probably the glasses case that did more to stop it. And notice, it's never a conspiracy. It's always an insane person who shoots the president. Always. Interestingly, because of that assassination, Teddy Roosevelt, who was deemed the most popular man in America, the most popular president in American history, he has run and did everything. You know, he'd been a cowboy, he'd been a sheriff, he'd been a mayor, he'd been a governor, he'd fought the Spanish in the American-Spanish War. He's the hero of the Rough Riders. He's like the best of the best. And so because he got shot, people didn't think that he would be able to sustain the pace of his pre-election rallies. And so Woodrow Wilson came in. Now, Woodrow Wilson is the one who brought in the Federal Reserve Act, started income tax and a whole lot of other things, got America involved in the First World War, helped start the League of Nations, an absolute terrible globalist. But he said, I'm the most unhappy man. I've unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is now controlled by a system of credit. We're no longer a government of free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men, who, by the way, ran the Reserve Bank. To quote one of our good friends, Stephen Mitford Goodson, who was director of the Southern Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank is not federal. It has no reserves and it's not a bank. And I think that sums it up pretty well. Woodrow Wilson was so bad that at the end of his terrible term in office, 1920, the Republicans had a massive landslide. They won everything. The House, the Senate, the presidency, and they brought in a whole scale of laws making it impossible for America to ever get sucked into a world war, a European war. And they brought in such heavy legislation, it was totally illegal for America to get involved in overseas alliances, to get involved in funding or providing weapons to belligerent nations involved in the war, or to join another European war. They were convinced they'd been lied to. He had run in 1916 on, he kept us out of the war. And immediately after he got re-elected in 1916, he got America involved in the war in Europe and upset the whole balance of power, brought about catastrophic collapses of the empires that had held Europe together and stabilized Europe for centuries. And the end result was that Americans were convinced over 100,000 of their men had died in a needless war for no good reason. And so what Franklin Delano Roosevelt was doing in the lead-up to the Second World War was completely illegal and jail time, which is, that explains a whole lot of other things too. Well, considering Teddy Roosevelt had been shot in an open car, you would have thought the Secret Service would have learned that's not a good idea for presidents to travel in open cars. But no, they put President John F. Kennedy into an open vehicle to tour Dallas, Texas, where he was very unpopular anyway. And that, by the way, you wonder what's going on. At first, people thought that Jackie Kennedy was crawling on the back to get away from the shooter. No, she's exposing herself to the shooter, or shooters, I should say, because a part of her husband's skull flew off at the back of the vehicle, and so she was crawling in there to collect her husband's skull, thinking part of it that had blown out the back of his head, which proves there was a shooter in front, because it can't have blown out that way if he has been shot from behind, as the official version says. The Kennedy assassination was such an obvious conspiracy and such an obvious cover-up, massive in cover-up. Now, Stephen Mitford Goodson wrote the book A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind, and he's got John F. Kennedy bottom center because John F. Kennedy intended to abolish the Reserve Bank and was already starting to print federal notes that weren't from the Federal Reserve that the U.S. government would issue without taking out a loan with the Federal Reserve Bank. Stephen Mitford Goodson makes the statement, all the wars of the 20th century have been bankers' wars. Just by sheer coincidence, the wars of the 20th century have always been against countries that don't have a Rothschild-controlled central bank. What a sheer coincidence. Just like Gaddafi, Assad, and so on today. Interesting, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one of the worst politicians in history, made the statement, in politics, nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. That's an interesting statement, and I regard that also with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Now, Donald Trump is bucking the system. He talks about fake news, fake elections, fake presidents, fake history, and he's rubbing salt in the wounds of the left, and they hate him. Now, they were, first of all, demonizing Donald Trump, using war words to demonize him in the media. That didn't stop him. They then tried indictments. They impeached him. They charged him legally. Now, it's been warned for several months now by Tucker Carlson, track the trajectory. They've used war words, they've used indictments, they've used lawfare. What's next? The next step is violence. And so there have been several people warning for some time, Donald Trump is going to be assassinated, or at least they're going to try. And remember, Robert F. Kennedy was preparing for the presidency. He got assassinated moments after he had been given the nomination. He was made the Democratic Party's candidate for the presidency, and with his brother, John F. Kennedy, having been so popular, he was a shoo-in, and so he is assassinated. And if you've listened to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's the attempted Democratic candidate, but the Democrats wouldn't even let him be voted for on Democratic Convention floor. So the son of Robert F. Kennedy says, the CIA assassinated my father and my uncle. And he's expressly open about it. They denied Robert F. Kennedy Jr. any Secret Service protection until, I think, only now since the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, because he's a threat to their system. And even though he's a death threat to himself, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Has not been given any security until now. So, interesting, but he's saying the CIA killed his father and his uncle. Now, another interesting assassination was that of Anwar Sadat. You might recall 1981, the man of peace, the man who signed the peace accord with Israel, he is murdered by his own soldiers at a military parade. He was suddenly attacked by his own soldiers marching past. They climbed off the vehicle and started opening fire on the president and all in the official presidential box. And this is because he signed a peace treaty with Israel. And the man on the other side, Rabin, was also assassinated after four unsuccessful attempts. They finally managed to murder him in 1995. And he had signed the Oslo Accords, which was bringing about peace between the Arab nations and Israel. So he had to get assassinated too. The first female president of any Muslim-majority country was Prime Minister Bhutto, and in Pakistan. She was assassinated after several attempts that were unsuccessful. She was finally murdered with a bomb attack. You can go all the way back to Julius Caesar, of course, 44 BC, and he is murdered by a conspiracy of 70 senators. 70 senators, including Brutus, his close friend, Utu Brute. And so even Brutus stabbed him. 23 stab wounds. The founder of the Roman Empire, murdered by his own senators, a definite conspiracy, 70 senators working together to assassinate this super successful general, so successful that all future emperors were called Caesar, after Julius. Britain, interestingly, has only had one prime minister ever assassinated, and that's Spencer Percival in 1820, and that was interesting story too. South Africa had a very high-profile assassination, which is very significant. Hendrik Verwoerd was probably the most intelligent, successful prime minister South Africa ever had. Under him, our economy was growing 8%. At one point, it hit 16%. Under him, the country was tarred. My mother said that when she first went up the N1, it was gravel road, and she'd have to get out the car regularly to open the farm gates for my dad to be able to drive through. So the N1 to Joburg was a gravel road with farm gates. But Hendrik Verwoerd changed all that and put us all on the electricity grid. And he increased education and literacy amongst black people in particular, something like 180%. And But houses he built, I've been told by people like Kenneth Meshew, are still standing. The houses, he built more houses than Mandela and Joe Slover did combined while he was a Minister of Native Affairs and Prime Minister. In fact, the houses he built are still standing, whereas the RDP houses built in 1995 and so on have fallen apart already. And under him, murder in this country was something like 65 people murdered a year on average. Under Mandela, 25,000 people have been murdered a year, not counting the babies being killed by abortion, which reached 80,000 a year pretty quickly. So he was an unusual man. When I went to school in Rhodesia at Milton High, I remember seeing H.F. Avot on the honor board. He had got the award for being the best English in the country. Now, remember, he was born in the Netherlands. English was not his first language. His father was a missionary in Madibeland, where I was brought up. And so, interesting, I said, is that the H.F. of what I was told? Yes, the very same. So he was an honor student, the best English in the country for his year. And when he was prime minister, he did some amazing things. At any rate, he was known to be sitting in the garden on Saturday mornings teaching his gardener how to read and write. Not the kind of person you would depict or think the way the media portrays him. Well, he got assassinated, and there were two attempts. The first attempt was Pratt, a South African farmer, who shot him twice in the face. Extraordinary that he survived. And Hendrik Verwoerd shot in the Rand show in front of 30,000 people who watched horrified as a man walked up to him and shot him point blank. Now, interestingly, the man Pratt who shot him was deemed a lone nut. No conspiracy here. Interestingly, he was under mind-altering drugs, and he was being, counseled, treated by a psychologist who was a member of the Southern Communist Party. And then he was murdered in the parliament by Sir Fundus. This man was a South African Communist Party member who was banned from the country because of his communist associations. And yet he not only got into the country, he became a messenger in Parliament, one of the most secure, respected positions possible. And he walked up to the President, Prime Minister, in the Prime Minister's bench, in the House of Assembly, and stabbed him multiple times in such quick succession. He knew exactly where to stab, and he had obviously been trained. A person in Parliament who said he was a medical doctor said this man could not have known without careful instruction by a medical doctor exactly all the vital points that, and he just walked in, he stabbed him in the Prime Minister's seat so effectively that the Prime Minister died. There was nothing they could do to save him after that. And interestingly, the man who replaced him for was B.J. Foster, who was the Minister of Police. So the man who failed to protect him, whose responsibility was to secure the Prime Minister's protection, is the one who became the next Prime Minister. Super suspicious, especially when Stephen Mitford Goodson points out that B.J. Foster was a spy for Smuts's government going back to the Second World War. So B.J. Foster presented himself as an Ossewaard Brandwijk supporter who opposed the war and things like this, and he was therefore already playing a double role, pretending to be Ossewaard Brandwijk when he was spying on him. The background to that is, and Stephen Mitford Goodson also wrote the book on Smuts. General Smuts was recruited to British military intelligence already back in his years in Cambridge, which is where MI6 tends to recruit their people. And so Smuts was working for the other side during the Anglo-Boer War. And that throughout the Anglo-Boer War, he did nothing that ever harmed the British cause. And he's the one that the British called on when they needed to bring all the Boer commanders together to bring about a peace at Vereeniging. And so Smuts was to use the Afrikaans term, a volksverraai. He was a traitor. And B.J. Foster was working for Smuts. Now, when the Second World War began, the British government wanted South Africa to declare war on Germany. And General James Barry Hertzog, Judge General James Barry Hertzog, refused to declare war, saying it's got nothing to do with the Union of South Africa. This is a Polish-German matter. This has nothing to do with the British Empire either. It certainly doesn't affect South Africa's security. No, we will not declare war. At which point, General Smuts did a coup d'etat. Now, how many people knew that Smuts was not elected to be Prime Minister of South Africa? Anyone know that? Smuts had lost 5 elections in a row to James Barry Hertzog, who was the most popular prime minister in South African history. And he just did a coup. He ousted our prime minister. Did anyone know we had a coup in 1939? No election, no referendum. Suddenly, James Barry Hertzog's removed from office, and General Smuts takes over Union Buildings, prime minister's office. And the first thing he does, aside from declaring war on Germany, is he moves all South Africa's gold to Simonstown secretly, and secretly uploads millions of pounds of gold onto the USS Quincy, the American battleship sent by American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to pay for Lend-Lease. And when the South African gold finally arrived in New York Harbor, then the Americans unleashed billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of free aid to the Soviet Union to prop up Stalin. This is the arsenal for democracy, by the way. Prompting up the most anti-Christian totalitarian dictatorship in history, biggest mass murderers in history, Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union. And, of course, Britain had to pay for their Lend-Lease, but Russia got it all free. Well, not free. South Africa paid for it. Only the South Africans were never asked, never consulted. It was never debated in Parliament. It wasn't even put in our history books. I had to learn that from American history books. Although later, Stephen Mitchell Goodson put it in his biography on Smuts, because as director of the Southern Reserve Bank, he had information about our gold reserves at the time and the inexplicable sudden disappearance of so much of our gold reserves, which is only answered by Patrick Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost the Empire and the West Lost the World, when he talks about all the gold from South Africa that Smuts sent on the USS Quincy to pay for all this. So the assassination of Hendrik Verwoerd, what could the possible reason be for? He had initiated the Hook Commission to investigate Anglo-American and their interference in the country and subversion of the country for communist ends, and to work out how to replace the Southern Reserve Bank with a truly South African institution, not an internationally run private bank controlled by the Rothschilds. So Stephen Mitchell Goodson's book exposes the fact the same people who assassinated the American President John F. Kennedy, and for the same reasons organized the assassination of South Africa's Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd. Because Hendrik Verwoerd was a threat to the globalist banking class or bankster class. And who did they use to do it? Boss. Anyone remember General Hendrik van der Bijl, is it? Have I got the name right? He is in charge of Bureau of State Security. So the head of South Africa's Secret Service, South Africa's equivalent to the CIA, organized the assassination of Hendrik Verwoerd, the Prime Minister of South Africa, and they were aided by the Minister of Police, B.J. Foster. They were aided by Anglo-American, and the American Secret Service were involved in this too. And they chose a man who was under psychiatric counsel at that time, treatment. So Fundus was, by sheer coincidence, a patient of the same psychiatrist who had been responsible for treatment of Pratt, who had shot Hendrik Verwoerd a few years earlier. So what's the chances of that kind of coincidence? Both members of the Southern Communist Party and their doctor, a member of the Southern Communist Party, but aided by the American CIA, who at that stage were using MK-Ultra, which is LSD, drugs, and psychiatric conditioning to make people to be lone nut assassins, to target them to assassinate high-profile figures. And so the same method that was used to murder John F. Kennedy was used to murder South African Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd. I thought that would be a little interesting to some folks. So, 110 years ago, on the 28th of June, the assassination that sparked the First World War occurred. 28th of June, 1914. The heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his wife Sophie, were assassinated in Sarajevo, Bosnia. Considering the catastrophic consequences, it's remarkable how little it's generally known about that fateful day and what led up to it. Security personnel and bodyguards can learn no end of lessons from what not to do from the catalogue of security failings of that day, which were unending. First of all, the scheduled visit of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand to Bosnia was published as early as March, and yet he They went there on the 28th of June, but months warning to any assassins of where they planned to go, even their route that they were going to drive. Sarajevo was a volatile, cosmopolitan, half-oriental community of 42,000 people at that time. For hundreds of years, this area had been under Ottoman, Turkish, Muslim rule. And the Austrians had liberated Bosnia and Herzegovina from the Ottoman Turkish Empire in 1878. In 1908, the provinces of Bosnia and Herzegovina were incorporated formally with the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The date chosen for the state visit of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand to Sarajevo was a date of painful historical significance for the Serbs. It was the anniversary of the disastrous defeat of 28th of June 1389 at the hands of the Ottoman Turks at Kosovo. Despite Austria playing a leading role in the liberating of the Balkans from Ottoman Turkish rule and oppression, because at one time all of this was under the Turks, this whole area. Even Hungary had been under the Turks. They had sacked Budapest in 1526 and took 200,000 Christians from Hungary back to be slaves in Istanbul. The neighboring country of Serbia was intensely hostile to Austria, despite the fact that Austria had done so much to liberate the Balkans. And Serbia wanted to greatly expand its territory to include all the Slavs of the Balkans, which was finally given to them by the Allies through the Versailles Treaty and the Yugoslav country, which was a Marxist hellhole, oppressive one-party state. And so the Serbs wanted to incorporate Bosnia and Herzegovina into Serbia. That's this area right here, next to Serbia and Montenegro. The Balkan War of 1912 to 1913, which preceded all this, had liberated a lot of territory, including Bulgaria, from the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Serbia was a monarchy, and having tasted victory against the Turks in the Balkan War of 1912, thanks to Austria, they deluded themselves that Serbia was a great power, able to even take on the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was really delusional. The head of Serbian military intelligence, Colonel Dragutin Dimitarovic, was known by the code name Apis, named after the Greek-Egyptian bull god. He also controlled the Black Hand, which was an international terrorist group run by Major Mojin Tankovic, Tank Osir. It was this group who provided the young Bosnians, including Gavrilo Princip, with the 4 Browning semi-automatic pistols, 6 bombs, and cyanide capsules in case they were caught. Very thoughtful of them. This was May 1914. Princip received some training in pistol target practice in the park in Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. Can you imagine doing target practice in the capital city park? Well, Colonel Dragutin Dimitrovic was described as a revolutionary fanatic. Pale, bald, heavy, enigmatic, like a giant Mongolian. Dragutin never married. He was devoted to the movement of Serbian nationalism and international terrorism. He was the godfather of terrorism. He required his revolutionaries to undergo a hooded initiation ritual, which included a seal engraved with a skull and crossbones, a dagger, a bomb, and poison. Murder had been his business since his involvement in the 1903 assassination of King Alexander and Queen Draga of Serbia. A brutal event. The King Alexander and the Queen Draga of Serbia were the targets of these revolutionary fanatics, and the King and Queen were murdered in their own palace bedroom by a group of Serbian army officers, which included this Dragutin. They were so savage and brutal and ruthless, they were disgusting the way they treated the bodies of the King and Queen and exposed them on the table and then posed on the bed of the King and Queen. Hardly a democracy, Serbia was described by many as a rogue state. Their rulers were intimately involved in international terrorism. This was a terror-sponsoring country. The evidence is overwhelming that the young Serbian terrorists who murdered Archduke Franz Ferdinand received their weapons and their training from the Serbian military, and their basic training was in Belgrade Park in the capital city. The Serbian Prime Minister, Pasic, informed the cabinet at the end of May that the assassins were on their way to Sarajevo to kill Franz Ferdinand. This was minuted in the Serbian government's cabinet minutes. Serbian state documents include details about the movements of the assassins and of the bombs and the pistols in their luggage. When the Austrians took Belgrade, they were able to find all this evidence of the Serbian government's involvement in the murder. And the interior ministry in Belgrade was fully briefed on all aspects of their mission. They were tracking them from Belgrade to Sarajevo. They left Belgrade 28th of May, they arrived in Sarajevo 4th of June. And yet they did not forward any warning to the Austrian authorities of this planned assassination, which you think common decency and the rule of law would require. From the Austrian side, the lack of rudimentary security arrangements on that tragic day is absolutely astounding. Acts of terrorism in and from the Balkans were a clear and present danger. British newspapers published cartoons of Serbian anarchists asking one another, "What time is it by your bomb?" And as Austrian Franz Ferdinand left the States on the 23rd of June 1914 to travel by train to Bosnia, he commented, "Our journey starts. Down there they will throw bombs at us." Doubtless he meant it as a joke, but that's what happened. The Emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Franz Joseph, had actually lost his wife, the Empress Elizabeth, to assassins, to communist assassins, although back then they were calling communist anarchists. And imagine, the Empress of Austria had been murdered by an assassin before this as well. An assassin from Serbia, mind you. And this lovely lady was targeted by an assassin as she was boarding a steamer to Geneva at that time, a 25-year-old anarchist, Luigi Lucin, stabbed her in the heart with an ice pick. And the most, as I say here, the most popular and beloved woman in Europe, ruthlessly cut down by an assassin. And he said, "I'm an anarchist by conviction. I came to Geneva to kill a sovereign, with objects of giving an example. It did not matter to me who the sovereign was whom I should kill." He was somebody who believed in communist revolutionary tactics, just kill any authority figure, in this case with an ice pick. And the people of Austria and all over Europe grieved. This is a terrible loss. In 1908, a 20-year-old Slav student assassinated Count Potocki, the governor of Galicia. And at the trial of the American-born Croats who had fired at a member of the royal family, the judge asked if he thought killing people was justified. The man responded, "In this case, it is. It is the general opinion in America, and behind me are 500,000 American Croats." Well, of course, the Americans did have a very revolutionary mentality at that stage, and they had a basic hostility and prejudice against monarchies, and so there was this idea that, you know, to kill a higher royal is justified. In 1906, an anarchist bombed the wedding procession of King Alfonso XIII of Spain, and King Alfonso was marrying a granddaughter of Queen Victoria. Praise God they survived this massacre, which killed a lot of horses and civilians around, but didn't touch the royal family, thankfully. In June 1908, a young Bosnian, Bogdan Zarajic, had failed in his attempt to assassinate the emperor himself in Moscow. Later, he traveled to Sarajevo and fired at General Marjan Barashanin, and it's alleged that the Black Hand of Serbia had provided his revolver. So Black Hand was involved in a lot of these assassinations. In June 1912, the governor of Croatia was fired upon in Zagreb, and although the governor was missed, a member of his administration was wounded. March 1914, the vicar general of Transylvania was killed by a time bomb sent to the post from Romania. Numerous conspiracies to assassinate officials were detected and prevented by the Austrian police. Interestingly enough, though, Gavrilo Princip was known by the Austrian police as a potential threat and a member of the Black Hand. Yet, when General Oskar Potiric, the governor of Bosnia, was warned of the threat from the young Bosnians, he only laughed. And the officials of Sarajevo spent more energy discussing the dinner menus and the correct temperature at which to serve the wines than any issues of security. You sort of wonder what was preceding the attempted assassination of President Trump last week. The Secret Service was obviously not that serious about their job. It's massive failure of security on their side. So on the 28th of June 1914, a date of intense significance for the Serbians, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand set out in uniform of a cavalry general, blue tunic, gold collar, three silver stars, black trousers with red stripes. And his wife Sophie wore a white hat with a veil, long white sash dress with red and white fabric roses tucked into a red sash. On the morning of the 28th of June, in accordance to the published schedule, which of course the assassins had details of, the motorcade left Sarajevo railway station. And shortly before reaching its first scheduled stop, a bomb was thrown by Nedokilo Kabrinovic, and it struck the car Franz Ferdinand, but was deflected before it exploded, and exploded behind the vehicle and wounded two bystanders. As Kabrinovic was led away, he shouted loudly, "I am a Serbian hero." The other conspirators lost their nerve and failed to use their weapons at this time. I think this is something significant right there, that when it comes to an assassination, you mustn't stop, you know, the survivors. He might be one of a team. Assassins often work in a team, and so you might blow your guard after the first attempt fails, but you're very vulnerable to the next, which is why now security protocol is if there's an attempt to remove the principal from the area immediately. And despite this attack, the Archduke continued with his published schedule, not even changing his route, meeting the Governor General, where he watched two local girls perform a folklore dance, and then, out of his concern for the bystanders who had been injured in the bombing attack, they went to the local hospital, and he visited those whose wounds were being treated because of the bomb that had exploded just before. And upon leaving the town hall, the driver took a wrong turn, turning left across crossing the bridge. Many other security disasters happen by having a driver who doesn't know the routes and the area well and making a mistake. A lot of murders and assassinations happen when people take the wrong turn. So there's the planned route, and then there's the altered route. And the driver was told to stop and to turn back when he realized they'd missed the turn. And the cars in those days had no reverse gear, so it had to be pushed backwards into the apple quay while the gear was in neutral. And this is where the dastardly deed happened. As they were reversing back, they stopped just amazingly right next to this Gavrilo Princip. And at this point, Gavrilo Princip walked up to open car, fired at Franz and Sophia Ferdinand at point-blank range. And he fired multiple rounds, and they all hit vital organs, and they died almost immediately. Using this very pistol provided by the Serbian military. The last words of the Archduke were, "Sophie, Sophie, do not die. Stay alive for our children." And sadly, they both died. Here's the tunic of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and absolutely horrific disaster. Assassin kills heir to Austrian throne and wife in the streets of the Bosnian capital. Royal couple shot after escape death from bomb. Interestingly, Princip first threw a bomb into the vehicle and then fired upon him. The bomb failed to explode for whatever reason. Bomb hurled into carriage fails to explode, uses pistol. And so this Gavrilo Princip succeeded in murdering them. They were survived by their daughter and two sons. 28th of June 1914 was actually Sophie and Franz Ferdinand's 14th wedding anniversary. I mean, how tragic is that? All these correlations of dates. Dates are very significant to assassins. The district judge, Leo Pfeffer, commented on Princip, "It's difficult to imagine that so frail a looking individual could have committed so serious a deed." And in fact, when Princip had volunteered to fight for Serbia in the First Balkan War of 1912, he was rejected as being too small. So he had a bit of a complex about that. At his first interrogation by the police in Sarajevo, Princip declared, throughout his life, wherever he went, people took him for a weakling and he wanted to prove them wrong. And this is, I must say, looking at this character that apparently was responsible for shooting at Donald Trump, he looks like some kind of transvestite. He does not look like a normal person at all. Apparently he was bullied a lot too, and apparently they can, you know, with a bit of mind-altering drugs and psychiatric work, can turn people like this into just direct, this target is the cause of all your problems. You know, kill them and you can solve all these problems. So amazing how many of these people are failures and weaklings who want to prove themselves. Within days, all the conspirators were in custody except for the Muslim Mehmet, who escaped to Montenegro. As Austria did not execute adolescents, Princip was either 17 or 18 years old at the time. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He died of natural causes, tuberculosis, April 1918. Before he died, he was asked by the prison psychiatrist, did he have any regrets that his deed had sparked a world war and the deaths of millions? Princip made it clear he had no regrets. This is a fanatic. Interestingly, Prinsep had killed the one man in the Austrian Empire who was committed to averting war with either Serbia or Russia. And this is very significant. The kind of people who targeted, like Sadat in Egypt or Rabin in Israel, they often, or even today, Donald Trump, these are people who want to avert war. And that is seen as a threat by the warmongering banksters. Franz Ferdinand had been the one member of the Austrian royal family who had good relations with the Russians. Franz Ferdinand was on record declaring, "I shall never lead a war against Russia. I will make sacrifices to avoid it. A war between Austria and Russia would end either with the overthrow of the Romanovs or the overthrow of the Habsburgs, or perhaps the overthrow of both." And that's dead right. That's exactly what did happen. He once wrote to the foreign minister, "Let us not play Balkan warriors ourselves. Let us not stoop to this hooliganism. Let us stay aloof and watch the scum bash on each other's skulls. Let us not get involved in this. It would be unforgivable, insane, to start something that would pit us against Russia." Franz Ferdinand's moderate stand was clearly seen by how, despite all the threats, he chose to make a state visit to one of the most volatile cities in one of the most unstable parts of Europe in an open car with almost no security to speak of. However, it is the practice of assassins to assassinate moderates to provoke reaction. I mean, who gets assassinated? Or should I rather say, who doesn't get assassinated? Joseph Stalin's don't get assassinated. A mass murdering thug like Mao Zedong, they don't get assassinated. You don't assassinate warmongering characters like Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And even in South Africa, you can say, the warmongers don't get assassinated. It's the moderate, peaceful people. That's what happens, like the French Revolution. Who did the guillotine? The most moderate reforming of all of French monarchs. Louis XVI, who had brought back Parliament, although Parliament had been closed for about 130 years in France. It's the moderates, whether you're talking about Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, it's the ones trying to bring about reform. They're the ones who get assassinated. They want to provoke reaction by assassinating moderates. The British ambassador in Germany declared the assassination was a dreadful act, of which the political consequences are incalculable. In St. Petersburg, Russia, the journalist dismissed the assassination as a characteristic bit of Balkan savagery. Almost every country in Europe had suffered the effects of assassinations by communist revolutionary anarchists, like Prinsep. There was general sympathy for Austria and disgust for Serbia's obvious role. So how did we end up fighting on the side of Serbia? The royal martyrs, the ones murdered, and their coffins and their tombs in Vienna. Yet just a month later, despite all the sympathy throughout all of Europe, most of Europe would mobilize against Austria's attempts to deal with the Serbian terrorist threat. And tragically, well, France had been itching for a war with Germany since then Napoleon III failed in his war against Prussia back in 1870. And France wanted a war, and they were allied with Russia. And Great Britain, of course, had no reason to get involved in this war whatsoever. There's nothing to do with them. But their king, Edward VI, had decided to, Edward VII, I should say, had decided to align Britain with France, and that was mostly out of spite for his parents, who were German, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. They were German, and in fact, the links between Germany and Great Britain were huge. They'd always been allies for all the wars, the 30 Years' War, the 7 Years' War, all these wars through history. It was a German unit that saved the British at the Battle of Waterloo, for example, in 1815 against France. France was Britain's historic ally. My father, who fought in the 8th Army all 6 years of the Second World War, said, "I can't believe we ended up fighting for the French twice." And to him, the French were the natural enemy, and he couldn't believe they'd end up fighting against the historic allies, Germany, which the British royal family is, after all, German. So, intriguing how Serbia here picks a fight with Austria, and it ends up with being a world war. Admiral Tirpitz said, "This war is really the greatest lunacy ever committed by the white races." Some people said this should have been called the auto-genocide of Europe or the Great Civil War of the West. Kaiser Wilhelm II said, "It's not I who bears the responsibility for the disaster which now threatens the entire civilized order." Now, he's been depicted as a warmonger and responsible for the war, but that's not true, because in all the years that he had been head of Germany, he had never started one single war. And yet Britain has gone through multiple wars during that same time period. And he's the only one of the heads of Europe who moved decisively to try and prevent the slide into war in 1914. Although he had given the Austrian support to act against Serbia, when the Austrian Archduke was murdered by the Serb terrorists on 28th of June, by the last days of July, no monarch in Europe was trying more desperately to stop Europe's plunge into war. And the Americans are putting Save Serbia, our ally. The Americans were so pro-Serbia that Woodrow Wilson had the Serbian flag flown at the White House every 28th of June throughout the First World War. Can you imagine? And the Versailles Treaty had to be signed on 28th of June to be able to give commemoration to that important date that Serbia was then rewarded in the Versailles Treaty by being given control over the whole of what then became Yugoslavia, which has not survived the fall of the Berlin Wall. Every country in Yugoslavia which was forced under Serbia broke away from 1989 through to 1995. And so America forced the signing of the Versailles Treaty on 28th of June to honor Serbia, to honor a terrorist who murdered a man and his wife on their 14th wedding anniversary. The Serbian flag flown over the White House every 28th of June, the Versailles Treaty has to be signed on the 28th of June 1919. The symbolism of dates. Proverbs 26 verse 17 says, "He who passes by and meddles in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a dog by the ears." You grab a dog by the ears, what do you think is going to happen to your face? And 1914 shattered Europe. An entire generation of young men died in brutal trench warfare. No other war changed the map of Europe so dramatically. Three great European empires were destroyed by the First World War. The German Empire, which had been the stablest influence that had protected Europe from the Eastern hordes, Huns and so on, for years. This father is the Hohenzollern Castle in Prussia. And along the Rhine, you can see some of the most magnificent towns and cities. You can't think of a better kind of castle as a model for Disneyland than Neuschwanstein in Bayern, in Bavaria. And just the kind of culture that could produce all this civilization. And Germany's produced some of the greatest music, Bach, Handel, Beethoven, Mozart. And on the German belt buckles was inscribed, "Gott mit uns," God with us, or God be with us, a prayer. The Russian Empire was destroyed, which had civilized the whole of Northern Europe, and Northern Asia, I should say, all the way to the Pacific. And this great Christian country, in fact, Russia had more Christians in it back then, at the beginning of the First World War, than any other country in the world. And there's more Christians in Russia today than there are in any other country in Europe. The Austrian Empire, which had protected Europe from the Ottoman Turks for centuries, was also destroyed. Three great empires destroyed by the First World War. Austria had held the line, protected Europe from the threat of Turkish invasion for centuries, like at the Siege of Vienna. 1914 marked the end of the greatest century of Christian advance, the greatest century of missions, and marked the beginning of what proved to be the worst century of persecution. The consequence of the First World War continues to have far-reaching repercussions to the modern day. And honestly, one assassination today, like of Donald Trump, might lead to the Third World War. Not that it would be caused by it, but the fact is, at the moment, the world is heading towards the Third World War. We've got the British Prime Minister, not just Rishi Sunak, who's just gone, but the new atheist Marxist who's come into 10 Downing Street. He's talking about a new Third World War and a nuclear war. And you've got Biden and his administration heading towards a new Third World War. So right now, about the only person in the Western world politically who might have a chance to stop this spread to the Third World War is Donald Trump. He's a moderate, the only American president in over 80 years who didn't start a war. And so that assassination might be what the warmongering gangsters want. And I have no doubt that this was not one lone gunman. I believe this part of a conspiracy. And how did some 20-year-old dweeb who looks like a transvestite end up outsmarting the Secret Service? And how was that most obvious of places not secured? And, you know, because the Secret Service are afraid of a sloping roof or something. It just doesn't make sense. You just look at this turn. as they entered the First World War, you still had cavalry. And soon you had cavalry wearing gas masks and with aircraft flying overhead with both fighter aircraft and bomber aircraft, trench warfare, barbed wire, machine guns, and artillery that killed 80% of the casualties in the First World War were artillery. When I've gone to the battle lines in Belgium, I've seen on the walls the names of 65 Hammonds. And the people whose names are on the walls are the people that couldn't find their body parts enough to bury them in a tomb. Because everyone who they could get their names, their dog tags, has a grave. So I went and checked how many Hammonds died in the First World War. 480, I'm told, by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And the fact is most of the soldiers were killed by artillery and they couldn't find enough pieces to identify who it was to find a grave for them. This is one of the biggest man-made holes. I know we've got Kimberley's Great Hole, but this was caused by an explosion. The British brought miners from Wales to burrow underneath the German front lines and set off an explosion to be able to create a way that they could cross, except when the explosion finished, it created this new lake, so they couldn't get across that anyway. But one of the biggest explosions of the war, man-made, and they could hear the explosion back in England. Russia mobilized 12 million soldiers. Germany mobilized 11 million. France mobilized 8.4 million. Great Britain mobilized 8.9 million, of which 250,000 were underage boys. I've been at the graves of 14-year-old boys in British war cemeteries, such as in Ypres, and one was discovered to be just 12 years old. And the recruiters were so obsessed with getting mass numbers that they turned a blind eye to youngsters, teenagers, even as young as 12, joining in the British Army and pushing them into the front. Including, of course, their colonies, Australians and Canadians, New Zealanders, South Africans, Rhodesians, Indians. Average life expectancy in the trenches was about 6 weeks. Italy mobilized 5.6 million, Austria 7.8 million, the United States mobilized 4.3 million. Of the 60 million European soldiers who were mobilized from 1914 to 1918, over 9 million were killed, 80% by artillery. 9 million were permanently disabled, crippled. Another 15 million were seriously injured, such as those attacked by the gas attacks and so on. Contemporaries called it the Great War. They didn't call it the First World War, it was called the Great War, because it was literally greater than any war that had been waged before that time. The numbers of soldiers involved, the numbers of casualties, the disastrous consequences, it was the most catastrophic event in the history of European civilization. Greatest explosions. Do not strive with a man without cause, if he has done you no harm. Proverbs 3 verse 30 says. And out of it came the Versailles Treaty, which was one of the worst treaties in the history of the world. Has to be recognized the worst failure of a peace treaty ever signed in history. The Treaty of Versailles was meant to guarantee peace, but it guaranteed the most violent, destructive century in the history of mankind. Absolute devastation, Second World War. The tragic legacy of Versailles is not that it ended the First World War, but it guaranteed the Second World War and led to the destruction of Western Christian civilization in much of Europe and throughout the world for over a century. Before the First World War, 64% of people in Europe were in church on Sunday, on average, 64%. After the First World War, by the beginning of the Second World War, 40% of Europeans were in church every Sunday. After the Second World War, about 5% of Europe was in church every Sunday. And my parents were amongst those casualties. My parents said to me when I got converted, "You cannot believe in God after the Second World War." So both my parents were so traumatized by the war and what happened, they were convinced atheists. They said God cannot exist because he had never allowed such things to take place. By God's grace, my parents did come to Christ, but that was a long battle and heart attacks, strokes, emphysema, amputation of mom's leg, all sorts of things happened before they came to Christ. But the World War caused absolute havoc. You cannot understand the history of the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe without understanding the pivotal role played by the destructive, vindictive Versailles Treaty of 28 June 1919. Galatians 6 verse 7 says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever man sows, that shall he reap." and what Versailles showed Second World War reached. U.S. Secretary of State Lansing said of the peace treaty that he and Woodrow Wilson brought home, "The Versailles Treaty menaces the existence of civilization." Now, if that was true then, the American meddling in Ukraine now menaces the existence of civilization today even more. Biden's war in Ukraine has got to come to a stop. The killing of so many tens of thousands, now it's hundreds of thousands of people, has got to stop, and it's insane. And Donald Trump's one person saying, "This must end, and I'll end it within 24 hours when he's president." And no wonder they want to assassinate him. "Injustice, arrogance displayed in the hour of triumph will never be forgotten or forgiven," said Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, in 1919. Alfred Balfour described of the Versailles Treaty these three all-powerful, all-ignorant men. Speaking about Woodrow Wilson of America, Clemenceau of France, and Lloyd George of England, sitting there carving up continents with only a child to lead them. Time to coincide with the fifth anniversary of the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand by Serbian terrorists on 28th of June 1914, which is credited as being the spark that led to the catastrophe of the First World War. This Versailles Treaty rewarded Serbia by giving this huge new country, artificially created Yugoslavia, which had five nations and four languages and three religions, two alphabets and two calendars, by the way, but only one political party, the Communist Party. And the main beneficiaries of the First World War were the Soviet Union and the Yugoslav Empire, which later became Tito's Communist Republic. 2 Chronicles 19 verse 2 says, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord, therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon him. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption." You could write 2 Peter 2:19 over so many of these politicians. They promise liberty, but they deliver corruption. Absolutely catastrophic to remember all this. And it all started with a terrorist from Serbia murdering an Austrian heir to the throne. By the way, before the First World War, France and Russia were producing 3 times more in terms of money and manpower and weapons than Germany. And they were on either side. And you can see how Germany was putting less money than Great Britain into the military budget, although they had a lot more manpower. That's 834,000 soldiers, France 794,000, 1,353,000 in Russia in armaments. And the surplus has got the money they're putting into the military budget. So you can see Russia and France were ahead of everyone else in amounts of money and manpower. And it's not fair here to blame Austria or Germany for the First World War. The British Empire, by the way, when they talk about Germany moving for world domination, well, Britain had world domination, France had world domination, but interestingly, a country that controlled a fourth of the world's population and a fifth of the world's land surface could accuse anyone else of militarism and aggression. You know, the Tsar hadn't even had one single war in his time in office, and yet Britain was having wars all over the world, and they'd just pulverized the Boers in South Africa in the Anglo-Boer War. Interesting, in 1902, Britain was the most despised nation in the world, and the Boers were the most respected people on the planet. Interesting, by 1960, the situation was so reversed, show the power of the media, that we were the most hated and despised, and the British were respected. Amazing how things can change. That a country that did concentration camps, scorched earth, murdered women and children in South Africa could suddenly be exalted as the saviors of humanity and liberty and so on. Not in Eastern Europe, mind you. So, this was the spark in the tinderbox. Micah 6:8 says, "He has shown you, a man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God?" That's what God expects of us. So, some of my sources, A.J.P. Taylor's The First World War. A.J.P. Taylor's a very innovative historian who thinks outside the box. There's other excellent books on the history of who started the First World War. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's blockbuster August 1914 on how Russia drifted into this catastrophe which doomed their empire and damned them to 70 years of communist hellhole. A very challenging book is Best of Enemies, How Britain and Germany, Who Were the Best of Enemies, Truth and Lies in Two World Wars by Richard Milton. Very fascinating book. Stephen Mitchell Goodson's History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind really gives one an insight to the role of banksters in fomenting wars, especially in the 20th century. The best book I've read on the First and Second World Wars, Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War, How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World, by Patrick Buchanan, who was the historian and the speechwriter, the researcher of President Ronald Reagan. We've got other books to help us reclaim our campuses to Christ and understanding history, some of our resources, many of which are available as print on demands and ebooks as well. And then we've given many sermons and lectures here before that look at these matters from different angles. The causes, consequences, and catastrophe of World War I, the catastrophic causes and consequences of the First World War, understanding the First World War, the best of enemies, evaluating Hollywood films on World War I, which is so fictional and distorted, it's both humorous and disgusting. Propaganda, we've had no end of propaganda thrown at us. Discerning between propaganda and real history. If they could have known what would become of the countries, they wouldn't have fought against each other, they would have fought side by side against a real enemy. And that's the sort of thing I got from my dad too, after his 6 years involved in the Second World War. Next time we fight, it side by side. He had more respect for his enemy than he had for his government back home. The main goal is smash communism, smash Marxism, get rid of idols. Today, the 18th of July, is in many people's minds Nelson Mandela Day. Well, the most condemned crime and sin in the Bible is idolatry, and it's condemned more than any other sin.